support and use the European Commission with its exclusive right of initiative rather than try to reduce it to an impotent secretariat. If national politicians do not understand how it all works, it's surely time that they learned. It is time to get the show back on the road, and perhaps this crisis can still be considered as a salutary one, but only if we learn from it. We can learn, above all, that if there is a disconnection between the people and the European Union, the main culprits are to be found at home, banging a jingoistic drum. Unless the electorate receive a clear and honest sense of direction about the necessity and desirability of what the European Union does and stands for, there can be little hope of this much-vaunted reconnection of the electorates with the European project. In other words, politicians should seek the source of the problem nearer home. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you very much indeed. Our second speaker is Robin Cook, who I really think needs no introduction, one of our two British former foreign ministers. Robin.
Duncan, the London Evening Standard has been helpful to our debate tonight by illustrating the problem. The first edition that hit the streets at about noon had as its banner front page headline, Schroeder's snub to Blair. That was replaced around about the third edition at 4 p.m. with Chirac's insult to Britain. It is a wonderful encapsulation of what we are up against. And we are not going to respond to that unless we start to dramatically shake ourselves and recognize that we do need a change of direction ourselves. I have been given 5 minutes. I'm not entirely sure whether after Peter that's shrunk at all, but I'll take those 5 minutes. And I want to outline in those 5 minutes a brief four-point plan as to what we need to do. First of all, Europe needs to take time out from writing treaties. The Constitution was extraordinarily the fourth attempt to rewrite the Treaty of Union in 15 years. There's a real risk of the European Union becoming a parody of itself as an institution that exists primarily to extrude ever longer treaties. I do not criticize the merits of the Constitution. It is a good constitution. It is not a beautiful constitution, but it's a good constitution. But that's not the point. The tragedy is that the politicians of Europe poured energy, imagination, and effort into talking to themselves about what matters to themselves. And what matters to them more than anything else is how they go about making decisions. If we want to engage the public of Europe, we've got to start talking about what our audience is interested in. And that means that Europe has got to shift its focus from matters of process onto issues of outcome. Less about how politicians make decisions and an awful lot more about how those decisions affect and benefit the people of Europe. So that's my first point. Second point of my plan is a specifically national one, and that is addressed to Britain. We need to find a tone of addressing Europe which is not one of insufferable self-confidence that we know best. No. Peter has already referred to the warm welcome that came to Tony Blair's magnificent speech to the European Parliament the other week. I think more than anything else, that warm welcome reflected an enormous sense of relief that they were not being lectured yet again and why Britain had got it uniquely right. We do need to modernize the social model of Europe. More than anything else, We need to put full employment back at the top of the agenda, which is what we promised back in Lisbon and then allowed to slip off the agenda again. Now, Britain has things it can bring to the table on that. Can legitimately offer some leadership and insight into how to progress towards full employment, because we have made dramatic progress in Britain in removing unemployment from the agenda and in removing long-term unemployment among our people. There are issues we could share there with Europe. But we will only get the rest of Europe to listen to us when we offer leadership if we, in turn, are also willing to listen to what the countries of Europe can teach us. For instance, how it is that virtually every other member among the 15 previous members of the European Union, existing members of the European Union, almost every single one of them have more equal societies than Britain, and most of them have better public services than Britain. So if we are going to construct a modern European model, let us not talk as if it is only we who have things to teach and not we who have things to learn as well. Thirdly, we need to make progress on the common agricultural policy, but we need to recognize that we're only going to make progress if both sides come out of their trenches and stop hurling insults at each other from behind the barricades. Britain needs to recognize that there has been progress on the common agricultural policy, particularly in the deal in 2002, which at the time, actually, the British government hailed as a great breakthrough and a success when it returned to Britain. In parallel with that, France needs to recognize that a lot more progress still needs to be done. It is not going to be revolutionary progress. I worry about those who talk as if the common agricultural policy is going to be put in the tumbrils and taken to the guillotine within the 6 months of the Labour government's presidency. That's not going to happen. Progress, and we better recognize this, is going to be incremental. There are obvious big steps that can be taken. If I was to identify two priorities for the British presidency, the first would be scrapping the sugar regime, which penalizes the European consumer and at the same time penalizes some of the cheapest sugar producers around the world. And secondly, scrapping the outrageous system of export subsidies, which means that we dump our surplus agricultural products in Africa at prices with which even the Africans cannot compete, and thereby we wipe out their embryo agricultural industries. Those are two obvious gains, credible gains, ones which would provide a reasonable test of progress under the British presidency. That does bring me to my fourth point, which for me is much the most important of all. And that is that those of us who believe in Europe have got to stop being so bloody defensive about it. My worry is that if we spend the next 6 months of the British presidency talking always about what's wrong in Europe and needs to be reformed in Europe, by the end of it, we will have convinced our audience that Europe is a failure, not a success. And there is no point, anybody on the left of center, lamenting the fact that the United States is the only hyperpower in the world, if we are not then prepared to develop the European Union as the only credible alternative geopolitical force that could provide an alternative vision to that of the United States. So let's hear it for Europe. Let's talk about, loudly, repeatedly, about what is achieved, that it has created the largest, richest single market anywhere in the world, the best basis on which our businessmen can hope to have the economies of scale in which to compete with the new giants like China or India. That it gives each of our countries the clout to succeed in negotiations on trade or in climate change, much greater clout than any of us would get alone. That it improves the quality of our environment, from the tap in our water to the beaches in which we lie down in summer. That it's provided real gains to consumers who've seen the cost of airfares across Europe and phone calls across Europe halved over the past 5 years. It is the best basis in which you can cooperate against cross-border crime and the drugs trade. It has given peace to the countries of Central Europe for half a century, despite the fact you cannot find any other half century in the history when they were not fighting each other. To the countries of Eastern Europe, it has provided a guarantee, an underwriting of their democracy and their human rights and their ethnic tolerance. And to the countries of the Balkans, the hope, the ambition for membership of the European Union is the strongest force for stability in their countries. An institution that can offer all that is an institution well worth saving. But it will only be saved if those of us who believe in Europe stand up and are counted and start to sound as if we're proud to be European.
Much indeed. Third speaker is Lord Douglas Hurd, who is again, I suspect we all remember, was a distinguished foreign minister under governments of a different political persuasion than Robin. Douglas Hurd.
Robin Cook and I have noticed already in our dealings with each other in the last few years, there's a perhaps a rather boring tendency of former foreign secretaries, however much they've disagreed when they're in office, to come together and agree once they leave, which is tedious for you, but saves me a little time, because I agree, as I did on Iraq on another occasion, I think, in this room, I agree with almost every phrase that Robin Cook used. The trouble about the need for a debate, in ideal life, you start from a marvellous set of propositions. We start this debate about Europe on two rather difficult propositions: no votes in a referendum and a bad-tempered argument about money. This is not an idealistic basis for a debate, but that's where we are. This is real politics, so we have to debate on those grounds. It's impossible to draw positive conclusions from negative votes, which doesn't prevent almost everybody from doing so. Almost everyone is scurrying around saying that what the French and Dutch no voters did was actually confirm, whoever the speaker is, his view of what Europe should be. And in this country, we have a particularly bizarre interpretation of the French no vote, that in some way it gave a mandate to our Prime Minister to abolish the Common Agricultural Policy. That's a fair summary, is it not? A good many articles which some of us have read, though none of us on this table have written in the last few weeks. But you can draw negative conclusions from negative votes. You can draw the conclusion about the constitutional treaty. It's killed, and I don't know what Minister Fisher, whom we're delighted to see here, will say about this, because it is polite to be polite to a corpse, and even a good idea, even a good idea for some limited time to breathe life into it. It's a form of courtesy, but not one which should be prolonged unduly, and I hope there's no real danger of that. But more important, it showed a dangerous gap between the European Union, its institutions, its leaders on the one hand, and Europeans on the other. And I'm sure that if there were a series of referendums, that gap would simply be confirmed. Please don't, Minister. Start, I don't mean you personally, but you collectively, don't start another philosophical exercise. I agree with what Robin said about that. In this country, and I've watched this over the years, a bane, a poison, a dead weight in the European argument has been this constant succession of high-sounding philosophical propositions, followed by nothing in particular except more drafts and more communique. This has a deadening effect, and over long term, a poisonous effect. Now, when one says that, please don't start another philosophical exercise, this is not an excuse, a plea for idleness, not at all. I see the Constitution now, constitutional treaty, as an attempt by someone who owns an old and rather untidy house to put a beautiful architectural facade on the front and say now it's a whole and a beautiful house. That facade has collapsed for reasons we need not go into. And there's now a temptation to say we need another type of facade or a new palace next door. Actually, what we need is to maintain and improve and make a success of the building we now inhabit, constructed by treaty, approved by all 25 of us. But there's a hell of a lot to do. There is work, there are materials in the builder's yard, there's a great deal of work to be done. And when people say, oh, but that's boring, that's useless, that's business as usual, it's business, but it needs to be done not as usual. By not as usual, I mean not in the way that has become common, and we all of us in different ways have had experience of this, has become common over recent years. The gradual ebbing away, the dearth of the imaginative generosity which brought the European project into being in all countries, including this country, at the beginning, but has now almost disappeared. I don't mean generosity in speech making. I mean generosity in actually tackling the agenda of Europe. If I run through it very quickly, you know, I will oversimplify, but the time is short. And I just choose four subjects just to name them. There is the whole question of jobs, the whole question of economic growth, the whole question of the Lisbon agenda, essentially a series of national enterprises coming together, but national decisions. I'm chairman of the German British Forum. And I'm asked to go to Dusseldorf and debate the question, does Germany need a Margaret Thatcher? No, of course not. Germany needs somebody who will produce in Germany on a German basis with German arguments a German answer to some of the sort of problems with which Margaret Thatcher had to wrestle. That is the difference, and the same is true right across the European Union. And of course the European institutions can help the Lisbon agenda. Deregulation, I welcome the change of mood in the European Commission. I think this is a good one. The stopping of much regulation and the beginning to look at existing regulation to see if it's necessary. This is the kind of thing which is needed. Second, the budget. Here I speak, crudely and only for myself. Of course it will be settled. Arguments about money are settled. It may well not be settled by the British presidency because of the British interest in this is so overwhelming and obvious. It may wait till Vienna. But it will settle. And the basis on which it will settle is also fairly apparent. Of course there is a link between the British rebate and the common agricultural policy. That's how the rebate was justified and granted in the first place. As the common agricultural policy is gradually reformed, whittled away, its grosser absurdities removed, so the rebate problem will dissolve. The link between the two is obvious, it's there. And it will work that way. It will take time, it will take a lot of bad temper before it's through, but that is what will happen, but it will need that imaginative generosity. Enlargement is a huge success. It's transformed the nature and the prospects of East and Central Europe. And you see now in the Balkans the magnet of the European Union drawing these countries not to perfect behavior, but at least to some attempt to show reasonableness in their dealings with each other and with the rest of the world, a reasonable concern for the decent opinions of mankind. That is the European, the EU magnet, which influences, imperfectly, but you can see it, the countries of the former Yugoslavia and beyond. It's terribly important not to lose that. And the same applies possibly to the Ukraine, possibly and eventually to Turkey. But linked with that is clearly an apprehension on the half of our own people, linked with immigration and all those problems. Here you need a settled, steady approach over several years, drawing these countries towards us. But it has to be accompanied with imaginative leadership, explaining to our peoples that this is a big opportunity, a big success, changing not just the west of Europe, not just the south of Europe, but the east of Europe into something quite different, something immeasurably better than our grandfathers or great-grandfathers knew. Climate change, I just mentioned that. But I think there will be an overwhelming view in this country, that this is an issue which requires European action together. And finally, partnership with the United States. No one can be satisfied. No country whose citizens are present here today can be satisfied with how Europe handled the Iraq question without going into the merits and demerits. We Europeans made a hash of it, I think, all of us. There is now another model, which may not work, where Europe and the United States have decided, they wish to dissuade Iran from turning itself into a military nuclear power. How is that to be done? It is being done at the moment, and thanks to you, Minister, for your part in this, by the foreign ministers of Germany, Britain, and France, acting with the consent, cooperation of the whole of the European Union, negotiating with the Iranians, a very difficult process. Blessed by the United States. Skeptically blessed, that is admittedly so, but they don't have an alternative, and therefore it is a partnership. It's not a perfect partnership of ideals and total agreement on tactics, but there's agreement on the objective, and there's agreement on the immediate way of handling it. And I believe that model, whether it works or not in the case of Iran, that model ought to repeat itself in the crises of the future, all along that arc of danger, from the Chinese border with the former Soviet Union right the way down and to Belarus. There will be many crises, in my view, in that area over the next few years, and they will require that kind of partnership, EU-US, and the idea of separate, effective German, British, French, Italian foreign policies in these kind of crises seems to be nonsense. That, too, I think, is something which would be accepted overwhelmingly in this country. So that is just a brief sketch of the agenda. But to make a success of it, it clearly needs leadership. And here I can speak because, like Robin, although he was very discreet and statesmanlike in everything he said, I can be a little bit cruder because neither of us share any particular responsibilities at the moment. It is a fact that the four major countries of Europe, the four biggest ones, are at the moment governed by leaders who are on the way out. It is likely that none of the four will be here in 2 years' time. You may think that this is a disastrous tragedy. You may think that it's rather a good idea. But it's a fact. And our present Prime Minister has got a great burst of energy going at the moment, and I agree with what's been said about his speech to the European Parliament, but he's not going to make, many more of these speeches. And a new generation of leaders is coming to the fore. We will have in this country, I think, a premiership of Gordon Brown. I think it is likely, though not certain, that in France, before too long, Monsieur Sarkozy will be in charge. It will be supremely. I have no intention of venturing into Italian politics. It would be supremely crude of me if I ventured into German politics in the present company. The German people will decide, probably I understand in September, who they wish to be their next leader. I would guess that all these leaders are likely to be positive skeptics about the existing institutions and policies of the European Union. I think they will gather that is the mood of their people. Now, skepticism in this country has been kidnapped by the wrong people. Skepticism has been kidnapped by the cynics, by people who don't actually, in some cases, don't understand what the European Union is about, in other cases, understand and do not like it, in other cases, understand and think that it's doomed to fail, or that it ought to fail. All these are grouped together under the heading of Eurosceptics. But skepticism, as everyone in the LSE knows, is a perfectly valid tool of the intellect. And it should be brought to bear with a view to success, with a view to improvement. And I will hope that the next generation of leadership will have that approach. Yes, being skeptical. Yes, being resolute in dealing with the valid criticisms where things have gone wrong or things have not gone right enough. But being skeptical with a view to action, with a view to determination that the whole enterprise will succeed. So in my happier moments, I see this new leadership and I see the agenda. The agenda I mentioned will take 5-10 years. And I see that in place of the search for a great new philosophical exercise. And if that were to happen, If that were to happen, then I think the European Union would be on a good course, a steady course, which it could maintain and for which it could gain the support of its peoples.
Thank you, Douglas Hurd. Last British speaker is the only of one of our British politicians who has not yet been foreign minister. Charles Kennedy, leader of the Liberal Democrats.
And please don't tell Mingus Campbell that Duncan introduced me in that way, or I'll be in big trouble, because I think he's got first claim. Well, ladies and gentlemen, there was always a bit of a happy danger about this event. Looking at the lineup, despite the cross-sectional nature of the party affiliations involved, that it would begin to sound, as the afternoon wore on, like a meeting of the Polish government in exile. And to a certain extent, that is the case. There is a positive reform pro-European government in waiting in this platform, which perhaps might be able to move things in the direction which we want to go. But in reflecting on the events of the last few weeks in particular, I think of somebody who I was privileged in his later years, became a personal friend, and I was certainly fortunate over that same period, became an absolute pivotal mentor of my own, and that is the late, great Roy Jenkins. And I've reflected upon what Roy would have made of the current maelstrom that we find ourselves in where matters European are concerned. And one of the many things that I learnt from him in politics was that when it comes to the big issues, particularly when the going gets tough, and let's face it, for pro-Europeans, it don't come much more tough than it does at the moment. Politicians and people can very often do their best when they fall back on their first principles, on what, in fact, are their core beliefs. Now, for me personally, Europe is a core belief. And that's why the referendum rejections that we've seen are matters of profound disappointment. Rather like Robin, I thought that although it's not the most elegant of documents, it was a good, workmanlike, necessary document, and we'll have to revisit it. And I also agree that I think that the way that thus far the British government have been responding to these events out with their control, in terms of the referendum campaigns and the aftermath, has been sensible and should be supported. I too applaud the speech that Tony Blair gave at the European Parliament. He's made several very good pivotal speeches like that during his time as Prime Minister, even one or two of them in Britain. And that, is it not, has been part of the problem over the years. So national leaders need to reconnect with their own domestic electorate. And I look at this very much in terms of my own part of the country. In the referendum campaign in the 70s, my part of the country voted no to Europe. Even in present circumstances, I would hazard the prediction, whether a referendum tomorrow, it would vote yes for Europe. Now, why would it do so? It wouldn't do so because of the arcane details of a constitutional treaty of whom few have heard and even less have read. It would do so because the tangible, practical benefits of European decision-making on people's doorsteps and in their communities and their prospects for better infrastructure, communications, employment opportunities and so on are there for all to see. Europe is not some concept. Europe is a reality on their doorstep and in their daily lives. That is what we've got to get back to in the broader scheme of things. So what, therefore, can we do in the absence of a constitution which I certainly consider to be moribund? I think that there is, as Peter was referring to at the outset, plenty scope for pro-Europeans to be making the pro-reform European case, which still moves things forward. We shouldn't be slow about coming forward in these matters. Open up that Council of Ministers to proper public scrutiny. Do we really want this comparison that keeps getting thrown at us, that the Council of Ministers in Europe legislates in secret on the face of this planet only in common with Cuba and North Korea, I don't think that's a very good rallying cry for pro-Europeans. Involve the national parliaments better in pre-legislative scrutiny, of course. And that has big implications for the way in which both houses of our parliament in this country go about their business. Complete the single market, push on with the Lisbon agenda, and push forward cooperation under current competencies, environment, crime, foreign policy, defence, and so on. And press on as well with enlargement, Romania, Bulgaria. Don't suspend talks with Turkey either. There is a great deal short of the constitution itself which the positive pro-European case can continue to make. And rather like Douglas, I do not, therefore, take this view which is being peddled in certain quarters, and we're reading it and hearing it a lot, that somehow we are all Eurosceptics now. No, we're not. We can be pro-European, but you can put the case for being pro-reform of Europe as well. I liken it, if you like, to being a Liberal Democrat Member of Parliament in the House of Commons. I've been there for 22 years. I don't agree with the basis upon which I've been fortunate enough to get elected, the system. I don't agree, with respect to Robin and Douglas alike, with the governments that I've had to look at over those 22 years across the floor of the House of Commons, but I still stand and engage enthusiastically to be returned for membership to the House of Commons, not just to advance my Liberal Democrat views and my cause, but also to argue the case for reform from within the House of Commons itself. Now, that should be the stance that Britain, as a top table player, plays within Europe itself. A Europe that's more decentralised, transparent and accountable. A Europe that protects human rights, civil liberties, the rule of law. Heaven knows we need to look across the channel to Europe for too many of those safeguards these days, the way that politics is developing at home. And a Europe that recognises that tackling problems can't just be done on the nation-state basis alone. Cross-border crime, terrorism, climate change, the environment, these don't recognise national boundaries. They require, by definition, countries to cooperate and build those foundations for prosperity and social interaction between nations. Complete the single market, indeed, as Robin said, boost Europe-wide the prospects of employment, and rigorously, throughout all of this, apply the principle and the practice of subsidiarity. That is absolutely key. But we've also surely, as we engage people in this ongoing debate, got to be quite honest with them about where the red light comes on, what we don't want. And I suggest that we don't want rigid and flexible labour laws, the Working Time Directive, that we don't want still more of this gold-plated regulation that keeps creeping in. We certainly don't want higher farming spending and export subsidies. So, in conclusion, three tests I would suggest you for this British presidency. First, and I'm sure Douglas is right, it can't all be concluded within the next 6 months, but progress on the budget, movement on cap, but it will require Britain to spell out in more detail than we've been prepared to so far exactly how we see that cap reform actually working through. Maintain that momentum for enlargement. Whatever the problems within what Donald Rumsfeld would call the old countries of Europe, it is surely not lost upon people that so many of the new emergent countries of Europe are still queuing up to want to join the club. Many countries which have been subjugated and not enjoyed freedom of expression and proper national right through generations, and yet they don't see any danger of a loss of that whilst becoming part of a wider European Union. And, of course, economic reform. Now, I personally have never had any difficulty. If you scratch me and ask me about my sense or concept of self-awareness and nationality, I say, first and foremost, I'm a Highlander, then I'm a Scot, I'm British, and I'm a citizen of the European Union. I don't find any contradiction amongst those gradations of self-identity and of a sense of nationality. I happen to be married to a born and bred Londoner. In our household, and we're bringing up a child now, and I watch this boy with interest and will watch even more in the years ahead. Here we are living in a united kingdom. Single currency, single language, single monarch, national parliament, all the rest over centuries. Intermarriage across the borders and so on and so forth. And yet, when the Scots and the English run out to play each other at football or rugby, Sarah instinctively knows whose side she's on, and I instinctively know whose side I'm on. We're both British, but we don't feel any diminution in our gut sense of national identity. What we've got to get across to more of our fellow citizens is that that's exactly what Britain's role within Europe can be about, on a pro-reform basis, without compromising, a pro-European stance. That is not Euroscepticism, that is realism. I think it's forward-looking, and dare I say it, I think it's also something that would commend itself to Roy Jenkins. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Charles. It's now a huge pleasure to introduce our last speaker, the Foreign Minister of the Federal Republic of Germany, Joschka Fischer.
Thank you very much. I listened very carefully to excellent contributions and really excellent analysis today in a beautiful English, though, as a not native English speaker, I have to apologize for my mistakes, but nevertheless, I promise you I will try my very best. From my view, and I share a lot what was said, but I think for the sake of discussion, it might be helpful if I try to present you the German or maybe the continental European perspective of the present events. I liked very much the picture of the house Douglas Hurd here presented us, but I have a different view. The European Union was a nice house built during the Cold War, and the back wall was the wall in Berlin and the Iron Curtain. And we built this house. When the British knocked at the door, first the French said no. But then we accepted the British apartment in that house, and it was a bigger house. Then we had further enlargements step by step. We improved our understanding of Europe based on our different perspectives. And at least from a German perspective, we thought this will go on, not forever, but for our lifetime, because nobody had the idea that this division of Europe, this artificial division of Europe, result of the Second World War and the Cold War, will come to an end by an implosion, by a collapse of the Soviet Union. But exactly that's happened. Almost overnight, it made boom. The wall disappeared. The Soviet Union disappeared. And a very conservative European community, rich people, we have a lot of problems, but compared with other regions in the world, we are not poor, living in a nice house protected by NATO and the Transatlantic Alliance, by our American friends, threatened by a common threat, the Soviet Union and communism. We lived pretty comfortable in this house, and suddenly, boom, the back wall was gone. There we are. Douglas Hurd, it's not a question of the facade. It's a question that suddenly we'll look to the blue skies when we look to the east. There was no wall any longer. And a lot of Europeans were knocking at the door. And these Europeans were and are poor. They had an interest to share our common values, democracy, human rights, independent media, a strong civil society, and peace. No dictatorship, a free society, no more wars, development. These are the shared values. And the problems the European Union faces today, I think, is a result of this historical moment. And therefore, maybe for a German, it's easier to understand the problems which are created by this unification process. We have a unification crisis. I was many times in France during the campaign, and I listened very carefully. And of course, put aside the domestic issues. But at the top, there was the same experience we had in Germany during the unification period. There was this East-West conflict that the Westerners think they pay too much, there is a competition of cheap labor and anything like that. And of course, I mean, the Polish plumber, you can see it now, beautiful man, in the newspapers. But this was an issue in France. And losing jobs to the new member states. This was an issue and is an issue, not only in France, but also in the Netherlands. Money, the contribution, the net contribution, was another important element. So from my view, if you look to these crises of the European Union, this is a unification crisis. And secondly, it's closely linked to the concerns about globalization. I mean, we have to ask ourselves why it was possible that a directive, a European directive about services, could be used and the commissioner could be used like the bad guy, like almost I experienced that from the No Camp in France, almost like Frankenstein's monster, that this is the monster of globalization. And Bolkestein, this was the name of the former commissioner, was used by the No Camp in a highly efficient way. So, enlargement, service directive, this was the practical term for the fears about globalization, losing jobs. These were the substantial elements for the French no, and the French no has had consequences for the Dutch no. Of course, there is another element, and this is, the third part of these crises. It's about the identity. What is this European Union about? I mean, the British position is a unique one, because you have fixed your problems with globalization for the time being. Your identity is quite clear. And unification is not such a problem for you. You are in favor of it. But for the rest of the Europeans, not for all, but for many of the European member states, this is a very serious challenge. Germany, let me now talk about Germany. I mean, Germany was in financial terms in the old Union, the driving force. And it was possible based on the strength, on the economic strength, but also on the strategic and political will, not only of the political class, but backed also by the majority of the people, of the voters, for the democratic parties. Germany, I mean, we are very grateful for that, and we didn't believe that this will happen during our lifetime. We experienced the miracle of the unification of our country, and now the opportunity of the unification of Europe. But on the other side, unification means also a tremendous challenge, not only in financial terms. So the financial source of this motor for integration, Germany, is now partly blocked. It's not open, it's not blocked by itself, but partly blocked. We have the second element, the adjustment of our economy and welfare systems, social systems, to a growing elder population and to globalization. We will have, or maybe we have an election campaign this autumn. Why? Why is the coalition in such a bad shape? Not because we sit there and think, well, everything is fine. No. I mean, Chancellor Schröder started with the Agenda 2010, a substantial reform of our labor markets, of our social systems. And it was very painful, especially for the social democratic electorate. So he is doing exactly what Tony Blair is asking for the European Union. And looking to Italy, looking to France, I mean, and knowing the history of the changes in your country, how many years it needed, and how many disputes have taken place, then we will understand that these parallel challenge of enlargement on one hand and transforming the basics of our economy and of our social system by peaceful means in a democratic society may lead to an overstress for many people. And there's a third element. It's the first time, and I am very happy about that, that not war is the driving principle of social change, but we have to learn it, to do it in a peaceful way. In continental Europe, my generation is the first generation where war was not the driving force of social and economic change. And this reflects on the other side, I think, the biggest achievement, the biggest success of the European Union. Because nowadays, I mean, Europe, the European Union, the idea of European integration was based on the experience of the 20th century and the self-destruction of the European state system by two world wars. And we experienced it, Robert, together, that the war came back to Europe with the collapsing Yugoslavia. We experienced this in the beginning of the 90s. And the answer to that war was not only a military intervention to stop Milosevic, to stop bloody nationalism. But it was also based on the strategy that the European people in the Western Balkans should move forward to European principles, European values, and open the door to Brussels for NATO and the EU. So when we talk about EU, we talk also about solidarity, we talk about common values, and we talk about institutions. And therefore, I would reject. The Constitution was not the result of politicians who thought, well, what can we do? We have nothing to do, so let's think about constitutions. How will you run a European Union as a union of solidarity and to understand what it means? In earlier decades, we fought wars, now we pay for each other. I mean, for Americans, this must be a very strange experience. And listening to the talks of the presidents of Mexico and Brazil in Madrid during the European Latin America summit, they were really astonished that these crazy Europeans, the rich North, is paying for the poor South or the poor East. So this reflects an element of solidarity. And the European Union as a common market will not survive without this spirit of solidarity and shared values. And you won't have permanent shared values and solidarity without common and strong integrational institutions. And you can't run a union of 25 together with Bulgaria and Romania 27, Croatia 28. And who will follow? You can't run a union without strong integrative institutions. And why is that so? Because the other element are the member states. And we all are based on national egoisms and national interests. So how can you bring these national egoisms and these national interests into a European compromise, into a common policy? This is, the continuous challenge. And Robin, if you ask for a time out for institutions, fine. Many on the continent understand time out for enlargement. They understand time out very well. In the ongoing election campaign, it means, well, be slowly with Bulgaria and Romania. We are in a crucial year in the Kosovo this year. We have now new opportunities with Serbia. And I think it was crucial that Haradinaj handed over himself to the court. So this put a lot of pressure on the Serbs and on the Croats. This is a crucial year. And then the Europeans will say, well, sorry, folks, we are not so serious anymore. We had a negative referendum. We can do that, definitely. But we will have to pay the price for that. Therefore, I think looking more closely to the no votes, it was not a no vote about more European democracy. It's some sort of tragic. If you look to Chapter 1 of the Constitutional Treaty, one of, I think, the major challenges is how we can strengthen the national role, the role of the national parliaments in the European legislative process, in the lawmaking process. Why is that so important? Because we must really interrupt that game blaming the Europe, the national governments are blaming Europe, Europe is blaming the national governments, and no one is responsible. Decision making without clear responsibility leads us into a dead end road in a democracy. This, I think, must be really brought to an end. And therefore, the national legislative process must be much more transparent and much more stronger. This was the idea of the principle of subsidiarity. And if we take the no vote serious, we must really consider how we can move forward on this road. Because otherwise, at least from my experience, it's almost impossible to bridge the gap between Europe and the national democracies and public opinion. Secondly, I mean, I experienced it very painfully. I started 7 years ago. At that time, the European Common Foreign Security Policy was just in the beginning. Nowadays, it's painful to see that we have three persons, three institutions. I mean, there is Javier Solana. He is the representative for foreign policy and security policy of the Council. Then we have the Commissioner for Foreign Policy. Then we have the Commissioner for Third World. And they are all human beings. And the institutions are also, I mean, driven by human beings. This will not work. Every 6 months, another presidency of the European Union. A commission now with 25 members. And we will see a commission of 27 or more. I mean, we can say that people are not interested in these institutions, but they are interested in results. And bad results, I think, will be of very important interest, and this will lead to a very skeptical or, say, negative vision of or a perception of the European Union. So I don't want to bother you with institutions because... But I don't believe that the union of solidarity, the union of shared values, the union of the common market, the union of common security, the union of freedom, and you are in a situation of an island, but for the continental Europe, the common space of freedom and security is crucial for us, also in economic terms, by the way, not only in political or everyday terms. I mean, you need a stronger institutions for the European Union. Now we got a severe blow. I don't want to hide that. This is, from my view, a major setback. I think the economic terms, to be serious, it's not very complicated to reach a compromise about the financial perspective. And I share fully what my colleague said here about these compromises. Yes, we have to transform our agriculture policy. Yes, it won't be done overnight. Yes, the British rebate under the conditions of an enlarged union cannot go on in that way, because otherwise a statistical effect. Now you have 4.6 billion rebate, and driven by the enlargement also of the budget, it will increase up to 8 billions, and this is not fair that this will be paid not only by France and some others, including Germany, but also by Poland and all the other member states. I think it's reasonable to reconsider this position. Yes, the net contributors cannot pay endlessly and cannot have an increase endlessly. There must be a certain security ceiling and all these issues, but I think we have the pieces on the table and we know how to put it together given the political will. But the problem is more serious. I think and I don't share the optimism of Douglas Hurd. What I experience now on the continent is not skepticism. What I experience is a lot of populism. To be Eurosceptic or anti-Europe sells. It's very easy to sell. And it's very tough to sell the different, the pro-European opposition. And Britain should be aware about the risk. When there will be substantial anti-European or Eurosceptic movements in Germany, France, and some other important member states on the continent, this will completely change the structure and the reality of the European Union. Therefore, I hope that Douglas Hurd is right with his optimism that this is skepticism and not populism. But I think we should move forward on all the tracks. Time out, if we want a time out, it means also time out by enlargement. This is dangerous. It's easy to say here in London, but to discuss in Vienna, in Berlin, in Paris, the discussion about timeout is a discussion mostly about timeout in enlargement. My position here is quite clear. I think we have our strategic interests. And strategic interests, what does it mean? It means the interest in peace. We cannot allow a development in a long-term period of a Europe which is not attracted, which is not part, which has not the perspective to Brussels. And Brussels means NATO and the European Union. I think this is crucial for European peace and stability. And we must continue with the integration in the common market of the new member states. It's very difficult to explain that it's not the member ship of Poland which creates the problem. It's a collapse of the wall. German business community invested much more earlier in Poland, in Hungary, and Romania. And it's well done so, because this will create an economic development there. And by the way, it's for the benefit of our industry. It's a benefit for our jobs in Germany. It's not directed against it. But it's very easy to mobilize negative emotions against these developments. Secondly, we have now not a timeout, but a reflection period. And if we look to these constitutional treaty, I think part one and part two. Part two is very important for us on the continent. I want to underline that, because as a Democrat, first of all, as a European Democrat, I believe in the common space of freedom and security. But this means that step by step, in an evolving process, we will transfer rights to European executive institutions, which will touch the individual rights of the citizens. And for me, I'm in principle in favor for that from a continental perspective, because this creates really added values in security and against organized crime, drug trafficking, and so on. But it creates also a better understanding. It creates new economic opportunities. But it means that we need the definition of basic rights for the individual citizen. Otherwise, this would be a step I would oppose. I hope that we will get the backing for that from our British friends, because I understand that there is a different tradition and situation. And in chapter one, we have all the elements of strengthening democracy, the subsidiarity principle, the common security and foreign policy, and the institutions you need for that. You have the permanent presidency. So you have a lot of positive elements. From my view, in the third chapter, this is our key communitaire. And as far as I understand, the opposition in France was mostly directed against this chapter. So we should reflect about that. We should reflect also about enlargement. My position is quite clear. But reflection means also we should, we set a timeline now with the Austrian presidency, but I think we need also instruments to move forward. I highly appreciate this debate tonight. We need more of these debates, and it must be a European debate. It makes no sense to discuss Germans to Germans, or it's okay, it makes sense, but I mean for a European process, we need the British position, we need the Italian position, we need a European discussion. And this is, for me, the positive experience of the French referendum campaign. It was the first time a real European debate, a real European campaign. This was my experience. This was a very positive experience. We should also consider whether we should tackle these issues about reform of labor markets, about what does it mean, a more social or a more liberal model. Is this confrontation really a rational one? We need this European debate. And even from the level of the trade unions, we experienced the crisis of General Motors, and this was a European crisis. This was not only a crisis in Germany based on the level of Opel company, it was also a discussion in Poland, in Sweden. So we have to continue with these European discussions on all these issues. And thirdly, I think we should prepare very carefully how we will proceed with these constitutional treaty. I don't want to continue this institutional debate, but we should be really very careful not to lose this treaty, especially not chapter 1 and 2. I'm sure if we lose this draft, then the risks for the Union are very high, because I don't believe that the European Union to 27-28 will work only as a common market. And if you believe that, what I believe, then one day you will need another effort, whether it will be this draft or whether there will be a new one or whether there will be elements. This should be very carefully considered. And therefore, ladies and gentlemen, it's not a question of my belief in Europe. It's a question of interest. We went a long, long road together. We have different traditions, different political cultures, different languages. It's a real union of 25. It won't be never a super state. We won't never have like the United States of Europe, like the United States of America. Because the Europeans are different. We are proud about our history, our culture. our language is. But on the other side, if we don't stick together, if we don't move together forward, we will be defeated. And I think in the world of tomorrow, in the world of globalization, looking to the new challenges, the new threats, looking to the new economy, the new competition, I think only a strong European Union can guarantee peace, security, and economic development and a free society in the 21st century. Thank you very much.
Very much indeed. As I think there are some folks with microphones which will enable us to take questions from the floor. But if I may just lead in very quickly while they're getting organised to one question that was emailed in, which is a very specific question. The French Prime Minister suggested last week that it was European collective pressure that allowed us to cut Chinese textile imports into Europe. Do the panel agree that protectionism of this sort is good for growth and jobs, or is that the sort of protectionist nonsense that risks impoverishing Europe for a generation?
We get a comment on that, perhaps, Peter, from you?
Yes, my position is that it was understood at the time of the creation of the WTO that the multi-fibre agreement would be stopped the 1st of January of this year. I do not think protectionism is the answer to the European economy. I think the opposite is the case. And I think we've had plenty of time to phase out the difficulties of the textile industry in Europe, because it's not merely China, but many other parts of the world that are better equipped to sell textiles in Europe than we are ourselves. And that is what globalization is about. It's also what equity is about, and fairness to the developing countries. So I don't consider this to be just a China issue, but insofar as it is, I'm on the open market side.
Well, I mean, from our national interest, I agree we are in favor of the open market, but I understand that some of our European counterparts have a different view, because they have to lose much more than we have to lose. I will give you another. I mean, sometimes things are very complicated. I traveled a few months ago through Bangladesh, India, and some others. And many of the third world countries are also very, very anxious about the consequences of the end of the multi-fiber agreement. And there is another element. I mean, for us, personally, for me, I'm fighting for years to reduce the tariffs and improve the market access of poor countries of the third world to the first world markets. And I think a lot as more as they can earn their money with their products and services on our markets, the better it will be for third world countries. Now, I made the experience that a foreign minister from a Caribbean island came to Berlin and complained about the sugar tariff reduction because his country, a very poor country and closely linked to British history, his country at the moment, based on the existing tariffs as an ACP country, and it's really very poor country, get three times more for the sugar exports to the European Union than it would get from the world if it would be paid according to the world price of sugar. So he said to us, this will be the end of our sugar industry. We are a small island, it's very poor. There is no alternative. Tourism is important, but this is not an alternative to our sugar industry. Please protect us. So I can't give you an answer, because in general I'm in favor of a better market access, But if this means to destroy a major industry in a third world, a small third world country, we need adjustments. And this is the reality. So I would be in favor, yes, of free trade, but we have to go into the details. It's very easy to make a confession to principles, but we have to look for the details, and if there is a need, we have to make adjustments that we won't have negative results.
Thank you. The gentleman right at the back who was anxious to...
Jamaica. Thank you. William Horsley from BBC News. A question to Foreign Minister Mr. Fisher. Welcome to London, Minister. Can I ask you to respond to the remarks by Jack Straw, your British counterpart, recently, who said that the no votes in France and the Netherlands meant, he said, the end of the federal vision of Europe. And I think he means the end of a certain idea of a European Union with strong governmental powers over nation states. And also your response to the British government's centrepiece of its presidency to examine the European social model on the basis of the mix of economic reforms in Britain and the strength of, for example, the German industrial model.
Well, sir, we do more than examine the social model of Germany. We try to change it. And it's a hell of a challenge. So if you want to come and examine our efforts, you are invited. And look, I mean, I'm deeply affected, and since decades, and many times I've been here in the United Kingdom. But I'm also affected by France and Italy and by my own country. And it's not my view of Europe to see there the paradise and there the hell or whatever. I think we have different traditions, and I like this these differences. We have different views, and this is an important contribution, because I think a European debate could be much more productive based on different traditions and views. For Germany, for example, or on the continent, you have to understand the role of the state based on the continental history. And there is a difference to the Anglo-Saxon history. Your history is a much more, I won't say easier one, but it's different from the continent, because wars on the continent, and you know that perfectly well, created a different view to the role of the state. And also class wars created a different view on the role of the state. And now we are the first time in the European history in a situation that the role of the state can be reduced. In Germany, we never experienced 60 years peace, and this will hopefully go on forever. No army, we are not threatening our neighbors. Our neighbors are not threatening us. We are the first time in the situation like you are used to be since centuries on the British Islands. So we have to readjust these relationship that the state shouldn't be overprotective and anything like that. But some of our achievements, I would fight for to defend. To get ill in Germany, I think, to get ill is a bad idea, but in Germany, it's not so bad. If I look to the infrastructure and some others, our decentralized system for example, I mean, there are a lot of very positive elements which are based on the German tradition, on a very positive one, and I don't want to implement that to someone else. But I want to keep that. This part of our, well, how we arrange things. But of course, we need a new labor market. We need we have a growing elder population. We have to adjust our pension systems and anything like that. But we will do it in the German way, and that's fine. It's not an alternative to the British way. We will do it. you can come and watch and examine and give us whatever you like.
What I fear may need to be the last question, to be fair, from upstairs.
Is a unitary European state necessary? If it is necessary, why is it necessary? If it isn't necessary, why is it not necessary? Could we have a clear answer to that question?
Okay. Could I ask each to have a very quick stab at that, starting on the far left here?
A single European unitary state is not possible. And it's not necessary. And it has been clear, in my view, for at least 15 years, that it's not going to happen, which is a great disappointment to two classes of people, those who actually passionately want it and those who need it in order to destroy or criticize the Europe that actually exists, which is a coming together, something unique in the history of Europe and the history of the world, a coming together of nations who are prepared to work together and subordinate their views to each other to an extent so far unknown. So far unparalleled. This is very difficult, it's very hard work, it goes on slowly and with imperfections. That's what we're about, and it's not a unitary state, as Minister Fisher said.
So why isn't it necessary?
Thank you.
Why is it not necessary?
Sorry, can we let's stick with
someone
the panel, please, if we may.
I think one of the problems here, apart from politics, is language, and it's not just whether it's the German language or the English language. It's the difference in people's mind that the English language has. If you cross the channel and you talk about federalism on the continent of Europe, they're talking about decentralization, they're talking about transparency, they're talking about empowering communities. If you talk about federalism in this country, it is that the Daily Mail thinks that the German foreign minister is about to invade Kent. That is simply not the case. Therefore, I think we need to be clearer about our terminology. When you talk about a unitary state, sir, the United Kingdom is a unitary state. It's a very unitary state in a lot of ways, although, ironically, it's a unitary state which is beginning to devolve itself with a Welsh Assembly, a Scottish Parliament, a London Assembly, hopefully a restart to the devolutionary process in Northern Ireland as well. So I think terminology's got a lot to do with it here. No, you don't need this mythical European federalist superstate. But if you have a single market encompassing a whole range of cultural and social and political diversities, and you have a single trading unit underpinning that market, it seems to me, for example, although the time is not right now, that inevitably the logic would point to our country being part of a single currency within a European Union. Now, is that a unitary state? No, I don't think it's a unitary state, because Britain's still Britain in the way that the Germans are still the Germans. It's a functioning set of institutions underpinned by market realism to give effect to the peace and the prosperity that Europe was built upon from the ruins of the Second World War.
Okay, we can switch to...
My apologies, but I have to leave, as I have to go and vote in my day job. First of all, a unitary state is not necessary, and a unitary state is definitely not desirable. There are so many ways in which we can cooperate together without actually infringing on the right to run those matters that are best resolved by ourselves as domestic states operating within our own context. Now, much more big than that, though, are two other considerations. I think one of the most fundamental problems we have with globalization is that it creates a very real sense of people feeling that their identity is threatened. And we have got to find a way in which we can relate to the real world and the way that the world is changing and operate within that real world, but at the same time meet that anxiety of people feeling that their identity is threatened. And that is one of the very powerful reasons why we do need to preserve the separate identities that we have within Europe as member states of this political union. Something very exciting, because it's something that's never actually been attempted before in world history, which is countries retaining their sovereignty, but at the same time pulling their sovereignty in order that they can work better together. And then the second observation I make is, With the greatest respect, the concept of a unitary state is terribly dated. I mean, this is the 21st century. We are not now talking about the middle of the 19th century of freestanding independent nation states. And actually, I think the whole concept of independence in the modern world is actually something of a problem in obscuring what we're trying to achieve. The great reality of the 21st century is not independence, it is interdependence. And that's why the European Union is so important to us.
Thank you.
I think that the use of these words is ultimately destructive. They are simplicities that don't work in the complexity of the world that Europe really is. In the end of the day, what we're talking about is a functioning place. It requires, in some areas, laws that transcend borders. And those laws have to be administered objectively from outside the countries in question, but by the consent of the countries in question, they are made. And that's what is meant by a supranational entity. We may argue about what areas those laws should cover, but surely none of us disagrees that if we were just an ad hoc collection of states meeting each other occasionally and wishing each other well, that it would work. It wouldn't. And I think the Foreign Secretary's reference to federalism was unfortunate, because it's one of those unfortunate buzzwords that sets off all sorts of reactions, usually adverse, when the reality, as we all know, is the European Union is sui generis. It's on its own. It is a different reality. Whether we go a little faster or a little slower, we may disagree about. But about the nobility of the purpose of sharing sovereignty in limited areas, there should be no doubts. It's both necessary and desirable, for all of the reasons that have been given, I think, by the panel this evening. So let's not get hung up on the shibboleths and the distortions of this sort of language, because it doesn't work.
I mean, as Mr. Federal in Europe, or I can tell you, we don't need such a super state or a European state, and it's irrealistic. And therefore, I think it's only a concept for the political debate, not everywhere. The European Union is a new system of states based on sharing common sovereignty and common interest. This is unique. It never happened before. And this is a new form of organization, how sovereign states are cooperating and not fighting against each other. And this is the real achievement. And if you want to meet a Eurosceptic, you would have to say to me, we all must become Brits or French or German or Poles. No, we want to live in our differences. And at that time, let me end this debate with two French sentences. Vive la différence, vive l'Europe.
Let me just, if I may, very quickly in conclusion say that we, the Centre for Reform, will, we hope, be continuing this debate on matters European through a series of seminars in the autumn. And then as we conclude, I would like just like very quickly to thank, in addition to our speakers, Helmut Hoffmann and his colleagues at the German Embassy for all their help with the technical arrangements, Anthony Rowlands and his staff at the Centre for Reform, and Alan Revell at the Conference Department of the London School of Economics, and, as I think is traditional, to thank the audience for their presence and participation. Thank you all very much.
Thanks a lot, Michael.